Hi, everybody. I'm Rick. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Here because I don't want to drink. That's why I come to AA. It's not why I came here when I got here, so if you're not here for that reason, that's okay. I have a home group. It's called the Action Group in Ocean City, Maryland. It meets Monday and Friday night at 8. I have a sponsor, Bob D. He's from Brooklyn. And I have a lot of guys that I sponsor, and I do service in my home group. And I say that that qualifies me for the recovery side of this thing, you know. The reason I said I'm a recovered alcoholic, you hear all kinds of controversy about that, especially from people who don't know, and it's to give hope to the newcomer. You know, there's some recovery from this hopeless state of mind and body that we have when we get here. And I was very hopeless, let me tell you. So if you feel that way, there's hope for you. Okay, and the way I got recovered from that hopeless state of mind and body was this program, 12 Steps and a Power Greater Than Myself, I refound from doing the 12 Steps. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. Now, the thing about me is I love to drink. I absolutely loved it. Bob said last week drinking relieved him from the bondage of self. I've been coming here for over 20 years. I've never heard that said. I've heard it said a lot of other ways that were close, but I never heard it said just like it is in the prayer, in the third step prayer. The third step prayer says we ask God to relieve us from the bondage of self. So there's two different powers we can use to relieve us from the bondage of self. Okay? And if you don't know what the bondage of self is, if you're laying there at 3 o'clock in the morning rolling around doing the shoulda, coulda, would'ves, you know, and taking her inventory and his inventory and, you know, if this one had done that and that one does this and this one had lent me some money and, you know, all this, that's the bondage of self, okay? Because it was all about you. In my case, it was all about me. I'm still very good at it. But, you know, I don't have to do it all the time. And I'm happier when I don't, you know. I'm going to read two lines out of this book, and then you see if you can see where they fit in to my story. One of them is on page 23, where's 23 here? Okay, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body, okay? That means you're thinking. My thinking is sort of screwy. And then on page 86, there's something that solves that problem. It says, before we begin the day, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Okay, so if thinking's the problem, there's a solution for the problem. We ask God to direct it away from all that selfishness and self-centeredness. So here we go. I started drinking when I was 10. I loved it. It did for me what I could not do for myself. It made me feel better. It made me feel a lot better. I was with a friend of mine named Chuck. He drank, he got sick, he didn't like it. I couldn't wait to do it again. And for the next 28 years, I did it as often as I could. Now, at 10, it's not that easy to get booze. You know, phony IDs don't even work at 10, you know? And I went to any length to get it. Okay, same solution in here. You're willing to go to any lengths, get the same results. Relief from that bondage of self, so I don't have to drink. See, because if I don't have some kind of solution for the relief from that bondage of self, I'm in big trouble, you know. So it worked real good for me. I went to all kinds of lengths. I'm going to try tonight to just give a little bit of the drunk part of it and more of the recovery. It's hard in a half hour when you drank for 28 years and have 20 years of sobriety. I want to talk to a lot of you new people, especially about when you get here. It's not, none of us get here on a roll. But I started out on a roll when I was drinking, And that's why I kept doing it. It worked. I had a lot of fun. Went to any lengths. One of the deals I did was, I remember going to any lengths. Sometimes you have to be creative, you know. And where I grew up, there weren't any drugs. At least there weren't any in the crazy cast of characters that I ran around with. There's a lot of booze, though. We like to drink. And I got a job in this bowling alley after school. And they had a beer keg in the bowling alley. And this little old lady was running the bowling snack bar at this bowling alley. And I said, "Can I have some beer?" She said, "Yeah, but just keep it under the counter, you know, so you couldn't see it." So, I mean, I got a lot of hours in, and I got to drink for free. So, that, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I did. I would go to any lengths. I found. Then I got a job in the printing industry when I was working my way through college. And the owner of the printing company says, the purchasing agent just quit, and we need somebody to be the purchasing agent. And I said, first question was, does it pay more? And he said, yes. I said, that's good. And I said, what do I do? He said, well, you just get a couple of prices, two or three prices on the paper and the ink and any outside bindery services or whatever, and try to save the company money so we can make a profit. I said, I can do that. Then one day the paper salesman comes by, and he wanted to take me to lunch. Okay, now here's where my magic magnifying alcoholic mind kicks right in, okay, our keen alcoholic mind. I said, I have to check. So I checked with the manager, and I said, he wants to take me to lunch, this guy Bob. And he said, well, yeah, that's part of your job to go have lunch with the vendors, okay? I translated that. Well, first I said, I only have a half hour. And he said, no, you don't punch out for that. Take as long as you need. Should have never said that. Right? So off I go to lunch. And this guy's got, I'm 19, working my way through college, drinking every day. And I'm sitting in this printing company. I'm trying to find a way to feel better. And this guy buys me some drinks, a steak. I get drunk. This guy's 28 years old. He's got a nice pinstripe suit and a new Cadillac. And he says, I've got to go play golf with another customer after I drop you off. And I looked at him right in the eye and I said, how do you get a job like that? I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up, just right there. And I was taking physics, so that was the end of the physics, okay? But anyhow, so now it's my alcoholic mind says that problem lies in our mind. Translated what the manager said is, manager said it's part of your job to have lunch with the vendors. I translated that as part of my job, and it's okay to drink at lunch. See, that's how we twist it around to fit us. That's what a self-centered mind does. We get it to. So everybody that was in the Yellow Pages that had anything to do with selling paper or ink or anything to printing companies, I invited over to take me out to lunch. And then one day I said to the paper first guy, I said, how do you get a job like that? When I got out of school, I'd gotten into marketing instead. And he said, well, you come work for me. And I did. And I started drinking my way up the ladder. This time I was married. I was very successful at it. I had a power greater than me working for me. Booze. And it wasn't causing a lot of trouble. I was married at this time. If you ask my wife, she may not have given you the same answer on that one, but it wasn't really too bad yet. And then one of my customers would, eventually one of my printing customers hired me to be a salesman for the whole East Coast, manage the whole East Coast for this magazine printing company out of Dallas. Okay, now I got expenses, and I got to have an apartment in New York, and apartment down in Fort Lauderdale, and I lived down outside of Washington, D.C. in McLean, and I thought, I have arrived. And now I'm drinking every day. And I would call my wife and say, I'm going to wait for the rush hour traffic to die down, and then I'm going to come home. Then I'd pay the check, see if anybody can ever do this. Pay the check, and I make the second call, say, well, you know, Joe just walked in, and I got to talk to him about whatever. And then start another check. And I paid a check again, make another phone. After three calls, I didn't call because I knew I was in trouble. But what was going on here was I meant to go home. Okay? I didn't know, A, I had alcoholism, and B, that I was powerless over alcohol, And until I was a couple years sober in here, and I got a sponsor who got me into the book, that I had the phenomenon of craving was working here, okay? Because I meant to go home. But I would come up with these stories. Sometimes they were true. Sometimes there was a Joe. Sometimes I would just make it up. And I didn't mean to. I was powerless of it. The phenomenon of craving was kicking in, and I was craving more booze. Now, my wife was not an alcoholic. She had three drinks, and you could bet the house on this, okay? On the third or fourth, she would knock it over. Her hands would start going, and, you know, she was feeling it, and she'd say, "I'm starting to feel it. I got to go home." I said, "I'm starting to feel it, too. I'm going downtown." That's the difference, you know? I wanted more. If I went home, there wasn't going to be more of anything, you know? So that's what I did. Now, when I got married and I took my wedding vows, I meant them. Alcoholics, we say and promise things, and when we're sober and we do this, sometimes when we're not sober, hungover, we mean them. And I really meant to stop. I really meant to go home. I really meant to not do this. But I was powerless over this stuff. Once that phenomenon of craving kicked in, I was off to the races. All the wedding vows were off. All the promises were off. You know, I'm going to be there for my son to help him with homework. That's off. And, you know, I really wanted to do those things, but I was hooked by this disease of alcoholism. Didn't know it. And, of course, you got to blame it on somebody. So it was her, because she was nagging me all the time. Right? That's a good, blame her. Because we have to blame somebody, otherwise we're going to have to change, even after we get in here. Problem is, when you get in here, they don't let you blame anybody. They make you take an inventory of you. So that's what was going on. So my disease is progressing all along at this, and it got real bad. I finally told the company I worked for where to go, you know, how we, you know, take this job and shove it. I started really going downhill fast. At the last 5 or so years, I started adding cocaine to it. It allowed me to drink all night, which made me just, the decline, instead of going like this, went straight down. And I wound up, couldn't keep a job. The only companies that would hire me would do it on a bet that maybe Rick would straighten out, and because we knew he was good at what he did, if we can keep him sober. And one night, we tend to lie. I tended to lie, and I was interviewing for this job, and the guy, I said to the guy, I just ordered a new car. I was a salesman, and I needed a car for sales, and I said, it's going to take 4 to 6 weeks for the car to get delivered. The real truth was they just repossessed my car, but I didn't think I'd last that long anyhow, and I said, I need a company car. So he says, well, I have a new company Lincoln town car, and he said, I got a second car. He said, why don't you drive that until your car comes in? So that was good. And the problem was, one night I was drunk in Washington, D.C. on 14th Street, and that was where all the go-go joints used to be. And I sold a company car to the bouncer at one of the go-go joints for $500. And I called in the next morning, and, you know, I had a plan. I wasn't a blackout drinker. I had a plan. I always have these plans, you know. I never checked a plan with anybody. I could have used the sponsor back then, let me tell you. He would have said, you're going to do what? And I called in, and he said, you better get in here right now. And we wound up buying the car back for $600. And he didn't fire me until we paid back the $600. So anyhow, so that's the stuff that was going on there. And one time I was up here in New York City. My friend Rich from Ocean City here, we were driving down the street, and I looked up, and there was used to be a bar called The Rendezvous on 52nd Street near Madison Avenue. And one night I was in there, and, you know, when you're drunk like me and lying and doing the things I did, I was full of guilt and remorse. And I really wanted to be a good husband and a good father. And so I called my wife up around 5 o'clock from the payphone in the back there, and I said, look, I said, I want to save the marriage. I really do, and I really meant it. I'm going to get the 7 o'clock shuttle back to D.C. We're going to, try to save the marriage. We'll have dinner and we'll save the marriage, right? Now, I'd already paid the bill. I got my quick magic magnifying keen alcoholic mind figures I have time for a couple more. So I had a couple more, and I go outside, pay the bill again, go outside, and at the time I had a limousine sitting right at the front door. And it was one of those 5 o'clocks where it's rainy and misty and lousy weather, and you know how hard it is to get a cab at that time of day. And I'm coming out the door, and there was a little overhang thing, and I'm standing, I just come out the door, and I had a blue suit on, and a blue suit coat, I guess, and this girl, pretty blonde, is coming down the road, and she grabs me by the coat and says, "You got to get me a cab." And I looked at her, and I said, "Oh, you have pretty eyes." And she says, "Oh, thank you, but you got to get me a cab." And I said, "Well, I don't know if I can get you a cab, but I'd be happy to give you a ride." And she says, "In what?" And my driver points to the car and says, "In this, it's his." And she says, "What makes you think I'd get in a car with a strange man?" And I said, "Well, I am strange, but I'm safe." And with that, she opens up the door, jumps in, and lights up a joint. Now, back to the quick mind again. Check it out. We can do this. She wanted to go to 82nd and Park. We were at 52nd Madison. It's sort of on the way to LaGuardia. It's going to work. Before cell phones. She says, "Pull over to the payphone." She gets out. She makes a couple calls. I'm watching my watch. She gets back and says, "I cancel my appointment. You're more fun." Now, she says, "I know a great place we can go." And I said, "Where?" And she told me, and we go there. Now I have to think, well, I can say that traffic was bad and I missed the 7 o'clock shuttle. I'll get the 8 o'clock shuttle. Okay? Well, long story short, we wound up in Maui, Hawaii. Now, when I made that phone call at 5 o'clock, I meant it from my heart. I wanted to go home and save that marriage. I have an alcoholic mind that lies to me, that rationalizes all the other stupid decisions I made in the process, okay? And working as my power greater than myself was the alcohol, and it was craving more. So now I'm thinking, well, I don't want to go home and just get yelled at. She's not going to let me off the hook anyway. Just let's go. To hell with it. So I don't know if any of you ever thought that way, but that's the way my alcoholic mind worked. And I wound up losing everything. It was my son's 10th birthday. I was homeless, okay, from that scene to homeless. And I owed a lot of people a lot of money. I was full of guilt and shame and remorse. And if you're like me and you're full of guilt and shame, you need something to relieve you of that. Because when you're suffering from that guilt, that's the bondage yourself, to even a bigger degree. And you just can't get rid of it. You got to get something to get that thinking changed. And the booze worked. And it was a vicious circle. It got me homeless. At the time, I couldn't see my kids unless it was their birthday. My wife had left me. And the last job I had, the guy said, "Look, we'll get you help. Or we're going to press charges for embezzling money from the company." And I'm thinking, I wonder how much time I'll have to do for embezzling. That's how bad my mind was. I mean, that's where my thinking was. Now I know why it says the problem's in the mind. And now I know I need to ask God to direct my mind, my thinking. Now I got God, I got sponsor, I got all you. If I bounce some of these guys off ideas off you, I'd say, "Prick, you probably shouldn't do that, Go home." But see, now I can do that. I can live a good life because of what I learned in here. So I go to, it was my son's 10th birthday. I did not have enough money to buy him a birthday card. It was that bad, and I felt about this big. My daughter, who was 12, came down and looks at me and says, "I hate you. You're nothing but a drunken bum." And they took me to the hospital. And there was a guy in the hospital who came, and he'd bring meetings to the hospital every night. And I thought, why is he doing this? But he told my story in there one night. That's why we tell our stories, so you can identify. That happened to me, And so I said to him after the meeting, I said, how did you get everything back? He had gotten to be president of his company. And I'm thinking, well, I was more interested in that than getting sober, okay? How do I get back? So I owed so much money. I was just in a lot of trouble. But it was attraction. I wasn't promoting anything. So he said, you willing to go to any lengths? And I said, like what? He said, I want you to go back to your room, get on your knees, say any prayers you can think of, and write a gratitude list. And I looked at him, I said, a gratitude list? Didn't you hear, I don't have any place to go when I leave here. I don't have any money, I don't have a car, I don't have a job. I've been sort of blackballed from the printing industry with my annex. Nobody wanted to hire me. And I was scared. And he said, write a gratitude list or you're going to die. And I went back to my room. I'm on my knees. I got a legal pad. I'm on the side of the bed. I'm on my knees like this, leaning on a bed. I had a roommate who was in the motorcycle gang. He was over on the bed playing with himself, right? And I'm sitting there like this, and I can't think of one thing to be grateful for. And I look over, like, oh, no. And finally it came out, God help me. I yelled it. And I know for a fact that God heard that prayer because a feeling of peace came over me. A feeling of peace came over me, and it was just, I knew it was going to be okay. And you know what came across my mind? Maybe there's hope. So I wrote it on the gratitude list. Maybe there's hope. So if you're new in here and you don't see any hope, see, I'm recovered from that hopeless state of mind and body now. Still an alcoholic. I'm only one drink away from a drunk, and once that phenomenon of craving starts, all bets are off again. And I don't want to be there. I don't want to go there. So I did it, and I sponsored myself for the first year plus. I wind up here. I had a coffee commitment at this meeting over in Hoboken. I went from homeless to Hoboken. I did not consider that a step up. Anybody here? I'm sorry. It wasn't that nice back in the mid-80s as it is now. Now it's kind of neat over there. But and I thought, so here's my mind again. My mind says, what a revolt and development this turned out to be, right? And what happened, though, in Hoboken, I found my sponsor. I refound my God, I found my wife, my current wife, and I got hope and I got a life. And it was because I wound up going to this the night I met my sponsor, he was leading a 4-step meeting over there, and one of the things he said was, I haven't had trouble drinking in 12 years. And I'm thinking, wow, wonder what he takes. And I asked him after the meeting, I thought there must be some kind of AA approved over the counter pill. So you can sleep at night, because I was full of the bondage of self. I had all this trouble in my life, and I was trying to fix it myself. What my sponsor calls that, he says, you're trying to fix what's wrong with you, Rick, with what's wrong with you. I thought, oh, that's not good, is it? And that's the truth. I was believing my lies, acting on them, and wondering I was getting the same stupid, lousy results. And wound up in a no-sympathy men's group where everybody had to share. Okay, and if you were sharing about the problem more than a couple of minutes, they'd cut you off. What page is that on, Rick? What step are you working? You know, it really pissed me off, you know, and it was easy to form a resentment list. All right, they were on it, and I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he got me into the steps immediately. He tells me on Thursday night we're doing a 5th step Saturday. Now, I'd collected all these tapes. They had tapes back then. They didn't have CDs and booklets and pamphlets and worksheets. I had a whole collection of how to do a 4-step. Didn't bother looking in here. The 12 and 12 was too long to read, right? And it was confusing. So finally, it forced me to. I didn't want to ask him after the meeting in front of these other guys to make me look bad, you know, how we don't like to look bad. So I called him. I said, how do you do it? And he told me to open it up, and he walked me through it. It took me about 3 hours. Saturday night took about 3.5 hours. And I started to see my role in all this mess. And he told me that, he said, during the 5th step, he said, your life's a mess on every front. He said, if you were at a company and you had somebody running your company with these kind of results, would you fire him? I knew he was setting me up when he said that. And I had, sure you'd fire him. He said, well, that's what you got to do. You need a new boss, new director. He sent me over to Serenity East, where where they would read the third step and the 11th step out of the big book on Friday night, and he told me to volunteer to read it. And I was a couple, 3-4 weeks into it, and I'm reading about bondage of self, self-centeredness. And he's that's the problem when we place ourselves in a position to be hurt based on decisions we make on self, you know. And it all started becoming clear. Told me to start sponsoring guys. And you know, that's a problem. Don't do it if you want to keep thinking about your problem, because you won't have time. Because they got problems. And if you've been around a while, their problems are worse than you. Every time I'd have a tough time in sobriety, I'd get a whole new cast of crazies. And I know they were sent from God. What kind of God is this, you know? I thought you're supposed to be forgiving and loving. You know, look at these characters he sends me, right? One guy wanted to kill me, Brian. And so we worked through the steps. You know, he said at the end, he says, well, lightning didn't strike. He also said at the beginning of the fifth step, a little prayer, he said, God, let us learn from this what you want us to learn from this so we can better do your will. And amen. He says, say amen, Rick. I said, amen. And I started learning that I was the cause of most of my trouble. Wasn't all the time. And what you did to me, that what I'd focus on, was a result of what I did to instigate it. You know, like not showing up for work. No, well, that's why they fire you. Oh. You know? I didn't put all that stuff together. And my buddies weren't sure going to point it out because, you know, they didn't know it either. So I learned all this. He says, God's not, lightning didn't strike, so God must be okay with this. And he said, your life's a mess on every front, Rick. He said, every front. Financially, job, living conditions, family, romantically, you name it. He says, you've worn me out over the last 3.5 hours. And I said, me too. He said, are you willing to let the same God help you with the rest of this mess that's kept you sober this year plus? And by that point, it was a no-brainer. It was a sixth step. He told me to read out of the big book, the sixth step. Just one line in here I want to read. And it says, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? What I admitted was, I just did it. I said, yeah. That's what caused all my problems. So then he told me to read the next paragraph, which is seven-step prayer. And he said, say that on your knees every morning with your third-step prayer and whatever else you say. And I've been doing it. I haven't missed a day. That was 19 years ago, I guess. And then we got right in, you know, I think he'd give me a break. Right into his, so now the eight-step list, we're going to go over that Thursday. I said, Thursday? So I did it. And he said, write what you think, who the amends for, what you think it is, and then we'll go over it. And some of them, he said, your amend to her is leave her alone. Quit calling her, you know. And to my ex-wife, he said, you know what your amend to her is? Because I would always badmouth her, and I was doing it in front of my kids. He says, you can't do that. You just tell her she's doing the best she can. Now, that was hard. But I started getting my kids back in my life. I said, we have to, in AA, they tell us we have to pray for people we hate. And I started doing it. I taught my daughter how to do that, and we got real close, you know, and my son. And we're starting getting close. So what I'm learning in here, I'm sharing with them, and I'm getting a relationship with them back, you know. And I had one, the biggest one on the eighth step was, the biggest one that scared me was the IRS. I hadn't filed in about 5 years, and I knew I owed him a lot of money, and I was scared. And he says to me one morning, he says, look, he said, you go down there to the federal building, and you go see him tomorrow, or quit wasting my time. He said, I'm tired of hearing you whine. And I said, well, I don't know what to do. I'm scared. He says, what's the matter? Is the IRS bigger than your God? I said, I think so. He said, here's the big thing. If you get nothing else out of this, he said, then you need a bigger God. And nothing truer was ever said to me. And here's when I started out. Remember, that was the other power that's going to relieve me of the bondage of self and all these other troubles. And so I went down there, and he said, I had heard Sandy Beach say in a meeting one time, he said he used to ask God to speak through him. I did that tonight. And he said, so I went down there, and I asked God to speak through him. He said, bring your pay stubs and your bills, and just, I said, I don't have anything left to pay him. He said, don't worry, just go. God will work it out. And I went down there, and I worked out a deal with this woman. She had forgave me a lot of the penalties and interest, and I made a deal. And it took me 12 years to pay that off. Thank God. Because what happened was, it got that, I couldn't have stayed sober with that over my head. I can't get a good job. They check you out now, you know, with these computers. And tax liens, they don't want to hire you. So I thank God he had me do this stuff, you know. So if your sponsor's telling you to do these things that seem like terrible, awful things to do, just see it through. All these bad things that happened to me turned out to be blessings in disguise, okay? My life today, my son, who is 10, got married in September, and my ex-wife and my current wife, my ex-wife says, can I ride with you? And we're all one big happy family. I mean, she's married and lives with somebody, but we got no problems with anybody anymore. I never thought that had happened. She says to me during the reception, she says, I'm proud of you. And I'm proud of what you did with our children. Now, that's not what she used to say to me. So, anyhow, AA works. My life is better. You know, I have a house. I live at the beach, you know. I'm sober. I sponsor a lot of guys. Every time something bad happens in my life, I can tell before it happens because I get all these new sponsors. Oh, please don't let this happen. But, you know, I get through it, and I've got a lot of sober reference. And people in here have been through all this stuff, you know. And that gratitude list, my sponsor makes me carry one in my wallet for days when it's tough because my knee-jerk reaction and not getting my way isn't to let people off the hook and accept it. You know, it's to get them. I'll figure out that. Bastard, I'll get him, right? So, and now I can pull this thing out, and it's, look at this thing. Two sides of a page. I keep adding to it. The last one I put on was Thanksgiving 06. I had 23 people in my family at my house for the first time in over 25 years. And my sponsor says, it's about time. Last time I had people over at my house, I didn't show up. So my life has come a long way, and it's not because of anything I did, because Rick trying to fix himself doesn't work, and you stay up all night worrying about it. Now life is good, and it's because of the God that I refound from doing these steps. He's friendly, he's forgiving. I try to do the same thing as him. I try to be friendly and forgiving. My sponsor taught me to let people off the hook. I said, what if they're wrong? He said, well, that's why you let them off your hook. God's forgiven you. You got another day of sobriety, right? If he was mad at you, he wouldn't give it to you. Oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. But that's the way I think now. I ask God to direct my thinking. So chances of me drinking today are very slim if I keep doing this. And the same, if you're new here and you don't see any hope, come see me after the meeting. I can show you hope in the worst situations because they all turned out to be blessings in disguise. From what a revolt and development this turned out to be, actually turned out to be the biggest blessing in my life. Thank you very much.